I'd like to welcome you to this particular session at the Sunstone Symposium Year 2000. I've been told that we need to start on time. I'm here to introduce our speaker, Kim McCall. I want to remind you that admission to the sessions, you either need to have a name tag or a ticket, and I do have a ticket, so I'm not trying to intrude on this conference without paying my way. He lives in Menlo Park in California. He's a computer scientist, software development manager. He has a BA in philosophy from Stanford University and an MS in computer science from Stanford University. He's published a couple of books, Mormonism and the Problem of Evil, Mormon Meta-Ethics, What Makes Right Acts Right Within Mormon Theology. He presently teaches gospel doctrine, and he loves to dance and sing. The title of his presentation and paper will be A Different Yet Still Firm Foundation, Non-Relativistic Ethics Within a Finiteistic Theology. And that's it. I'll turn the time over to you.
Thank you for being the people who didn't go to Michael Quinn this hour. I looked at the program and I said, no one will be in this room for sure, but we'll tape it and maybe somebody will want to read it. But I'm delighted to address this subject. I wanted to start by singing 20 years ago today. I spoke at Symposium. It was the second annual Sunstone Symposium. And it was at the time, I think it was called the Mormon Theological Symposium, or the church forbid them to call it Mormon, but it was, anyway, it's called the Sunstone Theological Symposium. And having I guess I was working on a degree in philosophy, or I just finished a degree in philosophy, I took this idea of theology very seriously, and I was interested to write a paper that was philosophically respectable and that had something to say that was really philosophical and formal and precise. And I wrote a paper that was called Mormon Meta-Ethics, What Makes Right Acts Right and Wrong Acts Wrong Within Mormon Theology. And going back and reading it, there are some arguments that I wouldn't make, but mostly I think it stands up pretty well, and I'm really happy with it. But it was a sort of a broad survey of what is ethics, what is morality, how do we defend moral judgments within Mormon theology, which I'll talk about what I mean by that in a minute. And it was intended to provoke more discussion, to open up more questions. It sort of treated a lot of subjects relatively superficially, and I hope that there would be more discussion. There were two letters to the editor and two mentions in other books. The White brothers wrote a book called Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy a decade ago, in which they talked about a tendency in Mormon discourse toward Orthodox, traditional Christian rhetoric, thought, understanding of the atonement, all kinds of stuff. And they traced this in the BYU religion faculty and some of the talks at General Conference and the writings of Elder McConkie and things like that. And they also talked about, they called traditional Mormonism the Mormonism of B.H. Roberts and of the King Follett Discourse, and they said there are still some defenders of this point of view, and they cited my paper from a decade earlier, which made me feel very good. And now Mormon America has come out, and once again, there's a whole section in this book that actually deals with the theological questions within Mormonism. There's a lot of Sterling McMurrin and Gene England and Blake Osler in there, but there's one citation where I should have the book. I intended to go grab a copy and read it to you, but we've been hurried here. It says it quotes a few things from my paper, saying that within Mormon theology, morality is independent of the will and word of God. Okay, and then it quotes Roger Lundgren, who is now the first letter to the editor, which responded to my paper, was by Roger Lundgren. He is now general church secretary of the reorganized Latter-day Saint Church. And he finds my paper very interesting and compelling, but ultimately unsatisfying, is his words. I have it here. The book, Mormon America, says that he attributes to me an antinomian relativistic ethic which reduces morality to the intention to be moral. Okay? And I'm just terribly delighted that the subject has come up, that somebody thinks it worth discussing. And when Todd Compton saw this in this book, he said, look, they've mentioned your paper. You ought to write another one. You ought to become a philosopher again instead of a social commentator or whatever I've been the last few papers I've given, and write this paper. And so defend, the traditional Mormon view, if I still hold it, or what the whites would call the traditional Mormon view. And so you can blame the existence of this paper on Todd Compton for encouraging me to write it. LDS theology, I was sitting in the, this is an interesting dynamic. This is going to be more impromptu kind of paper than the last one was. I was sitting a month and a half ago in the lobby of the church in New York City, the Lincoln Center Ward building, okay? And it was a half an hour till church, and there were two Mormons and one non-Mormon who had come over, was visiting from out of town and was attending a flute workshop there and had been dragged by a Mormon to church, but they were early. And so we were sitting around talking, and I said that one of the things that I hoped to do over the next month when I was going to be in Europe was write a paper on moral obligation within Mormon theology, and sort of the idea that Mormonism had a theology came around. And I said to this non-member, Mormonism has a really distinctive theology. And I just felt the woman who had invited her jump, that there is a tendency today, and part of the reason that I wanted to write this paper is that we are so anxious, I'll say this more formally in a minute, we're so anxious to win friends and converts that we want to not shock anybody. And we tend to downplay our theology. We tend to downplay our differences. And that is to, give up what we have to offer the world that's revealed. So anyway, I want to say Mormon LDS theology is really distinctive. If you think about our notions of the nature of God, eternal progression, uncreated matter, uncreated spirits, intelligences, it can be summed up in the slightly simplistic but compelling couplet, as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become. You may have heard that couplet's been in the news over the last year or so. Anyway, I do worry that we're becoming, in our zeal to win friends and converts, uncomfortable with our distinctiveness. This theology can be especially uncomfortable in an age of significant moral turmoil, when Mormons sense our ability to capitalize on our image as a bastion of righteousness and traditional values. On the surface, such an image is supported by a traditional theology with a strong, awe-inspiring God, and undermined by a theology that stresses the similarities of man and God and seems in danger of humanizing God and emphasizing his limits, which some of us do. Okay? And that it's natural to fear that that's going to undermine our strong sense of morality. Therefore, I think part of the explanation of the neo-Orthodox trend, part of the explanation of, okay, what is the neo-Orthodox trend? It's to view God as really, really other, okay? To widen the gap, to introduce more awe, more praise, more sense of, God is really not one of us, and soft-pedaling our theology. You may be aware that when President Hinckley was interviewed by the LA Times, he was asked about this belief that as God is, man once was, as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become. And he said, well, that's just sort of a little jingle or something. I need the real words, and I'm sorry I don't have them. But he sort of dismissed it. He sort of downplayed it. And I have not heard that line in church in years and years and years, okay? And I'm worried that we're in danger of losing something, okay? So what I want to stress is that something is actually at stake here in this paper. A public image-driven church leadership may be in danger of abandoning central revealed doctrines. I hope that's not true. And to a certain extent, it's not. Okay, there are things we're never going to give up. Okay, we're never going to talk about hell or get rid of the 3 degrees of glory and talk about those things the way that other churches do. But we probably won't give up eternal progression except for God. But if I accept this reality and I don't want our theology abandoned, I should try to show that its consequences are actually really good and something to be proud of, that they're consistent with true revealed religion. If you think about Jesus' ethical teachings, I'm going to try to show that Mormon understanding is really in line with those. It leads to believing the doctrine of morality that I'm going to preach today leads to a healthy moral development, to self-actualizing individuals, to a membership that we can be justly proud of, in fact, and it can even make for good PR. Okay. The next thing I was going to say is on some page around here. Well, you'll have to just guess what it was. Okay. So, I need to define just a few terms and make sure we're all on the same page when we're talking. As I talk about these things with normal people, their eyes start to glaze over, what is ethics? Okay, what is moral theory? When you say something is moral or morally obligatory, what is the enterprise that we're up to? Okay, moral theory, ethics, tries to answer something like the following questions. What actions are right and wrong? How should we live? And in particular, how do you justify statements like, thou shalt not steal? Okay. So there's certain statements that are in ethics, okay, like thou shalt not steal. Okay. But ethical theory tries to figure out how to justify those sorts of statements. What grounds are there for believing that thou shalt not steal reflects a real moral obligation rather than a convention, okay, or good advice or something like that, okay? And the effort to say in a formal, clear way what makes stealing, lying, or lusting wrong, or what makes doing your home teaching right, just to pick my biggest sin of omission. Okay, so after a little more orientation, here's the outline of the paper. What sort of ethical theory is suggested by or compatible with LDS theology? That's what I talked about in this big other paper 20 years ago. Okay. The letter from Brother Lundgren, or at least the paraphrase of the letter from Brother Lundgren that appeared in Mormon America, which is not actually accurate, accuses this theory of being antinomian and relativistic. I will define those and try to defend the theory and then talk about what are the practical consequences of actually believing in the theory that I'm going to propose. Okay? So, first of all, a few basic precepts of Mormon theology. The basic idea that's central to Mormon theology as theology, okay, as religion, you have to have a lot of stuff about Christ and about grace or atonement or various things like that. But as theology, the sort of central idea that's at all distinctive is that God and man are the same type of being, the same eternal species. Okay, they're ontologically independent and self-existent, okay, uncreated. Okay, the elements are eternal, spirit and matter are uncreated. Okay. Joseph Smith said, there's no creation about it. God and man are both subject to law. Okay, the idea behind this is we reject the idea of ex nihilo creation. Okay, the idea that God created the universe out of nothing, we reject completely. Okay, if that rejection carries any weight, okay, it has to be the case that God can't turn the universe into absolutely anything he wants to. If he could, he might as well have ex nihilo creation. Okay, if God can do absolutely anything he wants to with the elements he finds himself with, then our doctrine of ex nihilo creation is pointless. It's worthless. It means nothing, and celebrating it as a doctrine is stupid. Now that's not a good argument, but within, you know, all there really are laws in the universe that are independent of God, and those are, there are natural laws that sort of are about the nature of the stuff that the universe that God found himself in consists, if that was English, and there are moral laws, and I'll get into that, but the idea that there are that man and God are both subject to moral and natural law. The corollary, God didn't create himself, but create the universe, but found himself amidst its uncreated matter and other beings. Okay, that's straight out of the King Follett discourse. This earth life is part of God's effort to nurture our moral development and progression. Hopefully with a little help from us. Okay, if you're a philosopher and you take Mormonism seriously, or if you're an amateur philosopher to be in one of Albert's categories from last hour, you wonder what impact adopting an LDS understanding of the universe has on traditional theological issues. I will make a slight digression. There were two fabulous papers last year, one of the presenters is here, on one of the traditional problems in theology, which is called the problem of evil. And it's very easy to understand. If God is all so wonderful, and he's all so powerful, how come the universe is a mess? Okay, how come the world is a mess? If he is really good, he ought to want everybody to be happy and everything to be nice. And if he can do anything he wants, he could make it that way. And so the fact that there is a lot of trouble, either a lot of Nazism or a lot of earthquakes, take your pick, is a problem for people who believe in the traditional God. Okay, in principle, this problem is a lot easier for Mormons. If you really believe that the elements are eternal and uncreated and God can only do so much with them, that human freedom is uncreated and human behavior, there's only so much God can do to control that, it's possible to believe with Job and with Job by the end of the book of Job, with Rabbi Kushner, that God is doing the best he can. Okay. That, I mean, and I actually believe that. It's a wonderful thing to believe if you think about it, okay? That he's really trying hard, and that there are, that the universe without his help would be much worse than it is, okay? That's what Job came to believe at the end of the book. A possibly more challenging problem for Mormon theologians concerns moral justification, trying to answer the basic problems of ethics I mentioned above. In general, most traditional Christian theologians consider themselves to have a nice, neat solution to this problem. Okay, it runs like this. Since God created the universe and all of us out of nothing and for his own good pleasure, he owns us completely and has the right to make the rules. If God declares something wrong, it is ipso facto wrong. Man's moral status as subject is firmly grounded on his ontological status as creature. Okay. Most traditional theologians, including Brother Lundgren, believe that, some version of that. I actually don't. I don't even believe that if you assume that God created everything out of nothing, that it would give him the right to make moral judgments about the things that he created and to declare things they did right and wrong and have that stick. But that's a topic for another problem, paper. Clearly, the Mormon philosopher, confronted with the question of what makes anything right or wrong, can make no such appeal to man's dependency for his existence on God. In fact, it is intriguing that a religion that so narrows the gap between God and man should have produced a people so notoriously dutiful and obedient to God's will. If you think about it, why are Mormons such righteous people, whether it's self-righteous or doing the external things or something, there's something really notoriously obedient about Mormons, and there's some truth behind it, behind the image. And it's worth asking the question of why. And I'm going to try to actually get into that. I think there are multiple explanations. One is that we still perceive ourselves as a minority and we have to, you know, really do our job. But I think there's much deeper reasons that have to do with our theology, and I want to defend that idea. In my previous paper, okay, now I'm going to give you a summary of some of the things that you might think stand behind morality within Mormonism. Okay, if you try to say what makes anything right or wrong, what makes there be commandments, how can there be commandments that obligate us? I mean, if you look at this naturalistic view of the universe, that we're all just sort of there, okay, what makes my behavior right or wrong at all? Okay, it's nothing's right or wrong in physics. It's just there, okay, and we're in a physical universe, and the sort of the Mormon bias is toward an essentially naturalistic universe. Okay, what makes within that world anything more right or wrong than anything else? Okay, so I consider and rejected in the previous paper, and I want to go over this just for your edification, several possible ways of grounding moral obligation in the will or commands of God. That is, as viewing God as a moral legislator. Okay, the idea of God's moral sovereignty is that he gets to make the rules. He's a legislator. He says it's right, it's right. Okay, we could try making a limited version of the traditional argument, saying that while we might not owe God our complete existence, we do owe him a great deal since he's provided this earth for us to grow and so forth. This seems to ground all other obligations, however, on some kind of obligation of gratitude or recompense. But we're looking for the grounds of obligation generally, and these particular obligations are surely at least as dubious and in need of defense as the more simple duties like honest dealing that they are being used to defend. Okay, so gratitude to God or the need to respond right to a gift, that's some kind of obligation, sure enough, but that stands in need of grounding too. We're looking for grounding of that sort of thing. Another possible grounds for our duty to obey God might be promises we made to obey him. I go into this in great depth in the previous paper, and I'm just going by it really quickly here. We could have made such promises in the pre-existence, okay, pre-earthly existence, or in covenants that we make here. I think most people would say that there are things that are right and wrong for Mormons that aren't right and wrong for other people. Okay, and that's because of covenants that we've made. And so you might say we promised God in some general way when we were baptized or when we went to the temple or something that we would obey him, and so we're obligated to. But then we need to, once again, one basic duty, that of keeping promises, is being used to ground all others. We must then ask what makes promise-keeping morally obligatory. If it grounds our duty to obey God, then it itself must have some other ground. Okay, so we need a foundation for making anything right or wrong. Finally, consider the basic, though radically unorthodox, LDS teaching that as man is, God once was. If this is true in any meaningful way, it entails that God's relationship to morality was once as ours is now. He was subject to moral laws just as we are, and those laws are, and surely remain, independent of him. Okay? My favorite scripture on this one actually is one that everybody reads. This is the profound insight conveyed by Abraham's argument that God shouldn't destroy the righteous in Sodom along with the wicked. You remember, he's going to get into an argument with God about how many righteous people there have to be in Sodom before he won't kill them, before he won't destroy the city. And he says, far be it from thee to kill the righteous along with the wicked. If there are a bunch of righteous people, you shouldn't kill them. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? That's it. Those are Abraham's words from the King James translation. He's saying there's rules you got to obey if you're going to be righteous. If you're going to judge the rest of the world, if you're going to be the great judge, there's rules you got to obey too. Abraham understood this principle, okay, that God doesn't get to just say such and such is right and makes it right, okay? Abraham understood that moral law had just as much claim on God as it does on us, and God can't legislate the righteousness of his own actions. So I conclude that within LDS theology, God is not ultimately responsible for the rightness and wrongness of our acts, for determining their righteousness and wrongness. Morality is independent of the will or word of God in the sense that he does not make things right or wrong by willing or declaring them so. Okay? Now, there's another understanding of commandments, which is pervasive in Mormonism. Okay, if commandments are not pieces of moral legislation, we must view them as revelations, I think, in which God enlightens us concerning moral truths that are independent of himself. Okay, so if God's told us a bunch of things are right and wrong and obligatory, if he's not making them, he's just telling us the truth of what's right and wrong, okay, that's independent of him. Having such a rich conception of God's purpose in providing the moral experience, mortal experience for us, okay, we have this whole eternal progression, pre-existence notion that what earth life is about. Having such a rich understanding, conception of God's purpose in providing this mortal experience for us, Mormons have often sought in that purpose the explanation of God's commandments. From Joseph Smith's declaration that happiness is the purpose and will be the end of this life if we obey those principles, the commandments, which lead to it, through the humblest sacrament meeting talk 2 weeks ago, exactly this point was being made, Mormon discourse is replete with the idea that God knows what will make us happy, and he gives commandments to guide us toward that end. You know, there was a missionary homecoming, and the father spoke, and he gave his whole, wrote this whole explanation of commandments, which is that God knows what's going to make us fulfilled, what's going to make us happy, what's going to improve our powers, create our real freedom of action, and he gives us commandments because he knows that if we follow those, that's the path to our fulfillment, our growth, our happiness in the deep sense of happiness. There are, according to this view, quasi-natural laws that govern our ability to grow and be happy. That is, for example, a person who forgives another is freed from a torment and hate that impede the development of the ability to love. Okay, that's like a natural law. Okay, if you forgive, you get rid of the resentment that inhibits your moral growth and your development of love. Okay, knowing these natural laws, God develops moral laws intended to promote growth and happiness. Thou shalt forgive all men. Okay, that's in the DNC. In case anybody wonders. The problem with this roadmap to happiness view of morality is that it reduces moral laws to counsels of prudence, to good advice. Okay? It tells us how to live so as to be happy and fulfilled, but it doesn't say why such living is obligatory. If I'm told that jumping off the roof will break my leg, and I jump off the roof anyway, it makes me stupid but not sinful. Okay? If we generally think that breaking moral laws is really wrong, not just imprudent. You know, you're not just hurting yourself, you're really doing something that's wrong. Most of us think that. So if morality is truly binding and obligatory, thou shalt forgive all men is really the right thing to do in some sense, not just good advice. There must be more to it than the good consequences of obeying it. This is all straight out of Kant. If anybody knows about the hypothetical imperative, there's a whole bunch of rules like that that people live by, but they're not morality. They're just good advice. Okay, let's see. So, what kind of moral theory is suggested by Mormon theology? I'm going to try to give one. Okay, what kinds of moral principles can be adduced and defended within a universe where no external will can arbitrarily bind ours? And I have a footnote in the first version of the paper that says, at this point, my obligation, my indebtedness to Kant approaches plagiarism. Okay. What matters most in the Mormon universe is not so much. When I first read Kant's Foundation of the Metaphysics of Morals, is that what it's called? I think so. I was stunned by how well it fit with my understanding of theology. Okay, and not only, Mormon theology, but also a lot of Christian theology. What matters most in the Mormon universe is not so much the moral worthiness of actions that are performed as the moral worthiness of the agents who perform them. Okay, what's around in the universe is these people, and we're trying to make them better. And what we're after is better people, not just better actions. What's crucial in determining the moral worthiness of an individual is not so much the actions that he performs as his reasons for performing them. That is, the motivations or principles that govern him or by which he governs his actions. I allege. Our actions are morally worthy if our actual subjective reasons for performing them accord with universal moral laws. That's like a definition of morality, of moral action. Okay? Our moral actions, from the point of view of a universe in which what matters is the people in it, okay? Our actions are morally worthy if our actual subjective reasons for performing them accord with universal moral laws. Okay, that's still a definition. We haven't got any universal moral laws yet. Okay, but since this standard is being proposed as the fundamental criterion of the morality of actions, particularly prior to the existence of any substantive moral laws, conformity of the principles behind our actions with moral laws can only mean that those principles themselves are worthy to be made into moral laws. So the agent, to act rightly, must examine the reasons for his actions and ask whether he can, in full rationality and honesty, will that they should be universal laws. Okay. That was one paragraph, and I'm going to say it here. Notice that the previous paragraph, if its argument is correct, has accomplished an impressive feat. It has produced from an analysis of what it means to be a morally worthy agent and to act morally. It has proceeded from an analysis of what it means to be a morally worthy agent and to act morally to develop a fundamental moral rule. Act only upon principles that you can will should be moral laws. Anybody who's read Kant knows that I'm just practically quoting him, okay? Act only upon principles that you can will honestly, fully, rationally, should be moral laws. It should be noted in passing that this is but a slightly modified and philosophically phrased version of the Golden Rule. Okay? Which Kant doesn't mention. And I read it, I go, isn't this like the Golden Rule except philosophical? Okay. And this basic moral law becomes, through the personal effort to apply it in our lives, the mother of all other laws. Acting in accordance with this view of morality, we discover and, in some sense, legislate our own moral laws. On it hang all the law and the prophets. Okay. The idea is that we have one grand principle, which is just sort of, you got to act in accordance with the laws, even if there aren't any, okay? Which means that you have to be able to will that the principle you're acting by become a universal law. Now, you look at this particular principle and you say, does that work? And if it does, then it becomes a law. And so you're generating specific moral laws, like don't lie, or don't commit adultery, or don't lust, or whatever it is. You're sort of seeing those as specific instances of something like the Golden Rule. Okay, because the Golden Rule doesn't have a lot of specific content, right? Do unto others what you'd have them do unto you. That's not really quite right, but it's close to the thing that I'm suggesting. But it doesn't tell you specifically what to do in every situation, but you're supposed to apply it and derive from it specific guidance for behaviors in specific situations or general moral laws that are still more specific than this big mother of all laws. Okay. Did you follow that? When you read Kant, it's hard to follow, and I'm not sure if I've made it any clearer. But the idea is that that what we're interested in and what we think of as moral and what we mean by morality, according to Kant, is this correspondence of the principle between the principle we're acting on with law. And I think that's what we mean in Mormonism, And it comes out of the idea that what is the only thing that's really worth judging is people, not actions. Okay. Now that's really controversial. Okay. Kant's way of phrasing it is the only thing that's good in itself is a good will. Okay. Everything else is good for some other reason, but you find a good heart. It's not good for any other reason besides that it's good. Okay. And it's good in itself. And what it means, and Kant believes, and I believe, that you can unpack that concept enough that you can actually start to ground morality in a general principle of what it means to be moral. You can start grounding specific moral rules. Okay. This notion of morality involves the agent in determining what is right through developing moral sensitivity through committing himself to moral principles rather than submitting himself to a code or another will. Such a process enhances the self-realization and moral development that God purposed in providing this earthly existence. Okay. Now, it's time to evaluate this theory. I've already let's see, dive straight into the, I want to evaluate by diving straight into the criticisms that have been raised against this view and see whether they're convincing. Okay, I paraphrased the stuff from Roger Lundgren, Bruce Lundgren, in that's cited in Mormon America, that this view results in antinomian relativism and a view in which one is right just because one intends to be right, okay? Because one's trying to be good, one is good. And I wanted to read you a couple other things from Brother Lindgren's letter. If right and wrong, to get a sense of how people object to this sort of view, he actually objects. It's fascinating to see how far at least certain people in the RLDS, and I think the church generally, has come in the direction of traditional Orthodox Christianity. Okay. If right and wrong, this is quoting him, he's now the church's general church secretary of the RLDS Church. If right and wrong do not derive from God, God is not the source of moral obligation. If the elements were not created by God, then God is not the ground of existence. In what sense, then, is God really God? Mormon thought has, meaning Salt Lake Mormon thought, has deprived God of that which makes him worthy of our worship. God is God in name only. In essence, he has become nothing more than Superman. More conventional theists, such as myself, cannot worship a God who is simply a reflection of the limitations found in human experience. Okay? Interesting criticism. So it's suggested that the ethical theory that I've developed is antinomian and relativistic, and that it robs God of what it is that makes him worthy of worship. I will respond to these criticisms because I believe they are not even remotely accurate. But first, I should point out that my response could quite reasonably be, so what? What is so horrible about antinomianism, which I will define for you in a minute? Who says ethical relativism is wrong, or so much for your pet conception of divine worshipability? Okay. The point is that my job is to tell the truth about the grounds of morality based on what we are assuming, and I believe, to be revealed truths about the universe, not to provide a moral theory that must fit some preconceived idea about what constitutes heresy, like antinomianism, or one that makes people comfortable, universalism rather than relativism. Okay. These criticisms are completely beside the point. Okay. I mean, There's no obligation on true moral theory that it not be relativistic unless you can make a really strong argument for it. Okay, antinomianism. One or two of you might be wondering what antinomianism is. It was an early Christian heresy. If you look it up, this is what you'll find. It's an early Christian heresy that held that people are saved entirely by grace, not through any virtue of their own, but solely by God's good pleasure, and that this pleasure requires only faith and no obedience to any law or way of life. Joseph Smith, you might recognize, taught that this was a satanic doctrine. I completely agree, and I think my position is about as far from this as it's possible to get. Perhaps too far, as I've said nothing about grace at all, and hardly anything about God in my actual theory. Indeed, it seems to me that my position is in danger of sliding into an arid moralism. Okay. But perhaps Brother Lindgren had in mind a looser notion of antinomianism based on the derivation of the word rather than the specific heresy you find when you look the word up. Nomos is Greek for law. Is that right? Okay. And perhaps he sees me as denying that there are any actual universal moral laws, but that everybody is just supposed to try to be good, try to apply my sophisticated version of the golden rule, and that's all there is to morality. There are no real concrete laws, no commandments, and no real requirements for behavior, just for attitudes. Let me point out that the idea that God judges people according to the desires of their heart is not an entirely indefensible one if you read Doctrine and Covenants section 137 in particular. But this criticism is essentially the same as what I understand to be the complaint of moral relativism to which we now proceed. Moral relativism. What about the idea that my proposed theory promotes or participates in moral relativism? Moral relativism is the idea that there are no universally valid moral laws. What is right may depend on what society you live in, on your experience or disposition, or on your conception of what is right. Okay, it grew out of the anthropologists wandering around the world and seeing a lot of really diverse moral codes. And the societies function right, the moral systems seem to work, and who's to say that our set of rules is better than somebody else's? And so there was this idea of moral relativism. Some people responded that there were certain universals, like prohibitions against incest and murder, that were universal, and so not everything was relative. But all that misses the point completely. It's not about what people actually believe is right and wrong. Okay. It should be clearly, okay, but moral relativism should be clearly distinguished from situational ethics, which holds that some generally described actions, like lying, might be wrong under most circumstances, but right when the fact that the Pharaoh is going to kill you if you say that you are Sarah's husband makes it better for you to say you're her brother. Abraham chapter 2, verses 22-25. Moral relativism, on the other hand, denies the existence of any moral universals. And it's sort of a vague set of things like that. One of the functions that religion plays in society, I'm not saying it's religion's job to play this or religion is wrong if it doesn't play this, but one of the functions it in fact plays in society is to get people to behave themselves. Believing in a God who legislates universal laws and commands people to obey them seems reasonably likely to keep everybody more or less in line. A theory that portrays the ultimate moral life as a bunch of agents legislating their own moral laws sounds in danger of creating a world of moral chaos. And we've certainly had our fill of that lately, and we don't want any more of it, thank you. Besides which, in a world going to moral chaotic hell, we Mormons sure look good with our nicely scrubbed, obedient, faithful youth and members generally. How are we doing here? Oh my gosh. Two quotes from last Sunday's Sunday school lesson discussion time. Unlike the world, we believe the path is straight and narrow. There are absolute rights and wrongs. Okay. So what about relativism? Is the golden rule relativistic? Okay. That is to say, does it prescribe any rights and wrongs, or does it just depend on you? In the naive form, maybe it is. Okay, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. That depends on what you want them to do to you, sort of in the naive form. But in the real, complete form, act only from those principles which you can really will become universal laws for everybody. It's not. Okay, I need to argue for that a little bit better. But we want to make this distinction. First of all, there's this one categorical principle, which is that one that I just expressed. It's not relative, okay? That's an absolute, according to what righteousness or morality means. And also, when you start applying it, you apply it not according to your own whims, but according to rationality, and people can't, you know, there's generally one way to apply it, and it results in a bunch of derived rules, okay? And I need to articulate that and defend that a little bit better, and we don't have a lot of time. But, you know, you can't apply that and get it's okay to lie whenever you feel like it or it's going to get you out of embarrassment, okay? You just can't get that principle and universalize it because it destroys the possibility of promising, which is what lying is based on, the opposite of being. You can't even logically do it according to Kant, and I believe that. So there are only certain ways that you can rationally and consistently apply that general principle to get specific principles, and so there are real commandments, okay? There are specific laws that are morally right that are the specific manifestations of that general rule, okay? And in that sense, it's not relativistic, okay? What is the status of the specific concrete commandments? Most of them, at least those of universal applicability, are specific instances of applying the general rule. They derive their obligatory force because they accord with the only valid ways of applying the golden rule. But still, even though the specific rules may be universal, the true moral life, I want to emphasize, we may have actual commandments, okay, which are these specific thou shalt and thou shalt nots that grow out of the general law. The true moral life, the deepest moral life in LES theology, can't consist merely in living by those rules, but in the process of coming up with them and developing the wisdom and the will to live thus responsibly and generously. responsibly and generously. Brother argument, the argument from worshipability. I'll just go through this really, really fast. Brother Lindgren, repudiates Mormon theology generally and advocates a more conventional theism on the grounds that the LDS denial to God of ultimate creation and ultimate moral legislation deprive him of that which makes him worthy of our worship. He cannot worship a God who is simply a reflection of the limitations found in human experience. But I respond that insisting that we limit our notions of God to what we currently consider worthy of worship is placing human limits on his ability to reveal himself. Thus, do we create a God fashioned after our own weaknesses, desires, and needs. This is far worse form of creating God in our own image than the anthropomorphism Mormonism is accused of. For Mormons, God is who and whatever he is, and he, in fact, fits some criteria we may have for him only by happenstance. Okay, I would make the argument that it's only religions like Mormonism that believe in real revelation. I mean, God is the guy who showed up on Joseph Smith's doorstep, okay? And whatever you wanted to believe about him, about his character, about his nature, about his history, doesn't matter. He is that individual, okay? And Mormons believe in a real God, okay? Rather than a God that grows out of our definitions, of our idea of what's worshipable, praiseworthy, or anything else. In that sense, Mormons can claim a level of degree of belief in a real God that it's hard for people whose religion is more a rationally centric, Platonic-based one to claim. I don't want to say that. I don't want to disparage other religions, but there's a kind of believing that Mormons have that's really radical. Okay. This may be fine in theory, but before I proceed to extol the great virtues of this theory, let me deal with the problem of whether it's a good idea to teach it to your kids. Is it possible that this is one of those truths that it's better not to know, at least not until you're ready for it? After all, doesn't God want us to view the commandments as commandments and just obey them? Okay, if you love me, keep my commandments. Okay, my response is but a guess and a suggestion. The law of Moses was a step in the moral progression of mankind. The law of carnal commandments, which is what I think of as like the Ten Commandments, basically, generally seems likewise like a schoolmaster, a tutor, to teach us right and wrong and keep us from ill while we are developing the character and moral capacities to live a higher form of morality than mere obedience to rules. The developmental psychologists tell us that we progress through stages of moral development. At one stage, we need to know what we'll be punished for. At another, we need to know specific black and white rules. Eventually, we're able to act on principles and values rather than rules, and we can become more self-determining. Adolescents seem to need rules and boundaries, and it may be that preaching the concrete commandments, which are, after all, genuine applications of the outgrowth of the Great Commandment, is the correct approach. But we should remember that to teach that morality consists solely in obedience to such commandments is to encourage permanent moral adolescence. We should instead encourage ourselves to reflection, to basing our actions on fairness, on other concern, on love, rather than on rote obedience. Okay. I'm nearly out of time, and we do want to discuss a little bit, but we do have 10 minutes, and I have to read the punchlines. Why we should feel good about this understanding morality. First of all, the usual religious alternative is absurd. I shouldn't really do this, but to claim that things are good or bad, right or wrong, simply because God declares them to be so, means that God's own goodness is trivial and automatic. When we sense or praise God's goodness, we are not saying that he does whatever he says is right, but that he conforms to some genuine goodness independent of his own dictates. He could not arbitrarily legislate lying to be morally good, generally. This is not to say, as Brother Lindgren thinks I say, that the conventional theist believes in a God whose will and dictates are arbitrary, but saying that they are not arbitrary presupposes some external standard against which they can be judged appropriate and non-arbitrary. Finally, let me call attention to the fact that this is a challenging, demanding view of morality. Adopting it calls us to genuine... this is my punchline. I should be able to read it. This is a challenging, demanding view of morality. Adopting it calls us to genuine moral decision-making and enriches our moral experience. It is a positive, ennobling, life-affirming theory. Its positive view of human moral potential and dignity would reduce the appeal of the dark side of Satanism, of Littletonism. Surely it is more affirmative to view yourself as a moral legislator than to view your main moral purpose as submission to the will of another or to authority. The latter invites resentment or rebellion, while the former encourages responsibility. In fact, I hold that a great deal of the goodness of our people, the cohesiveness of our families, and the healthy, happy lives the world sees us living do result from our theology, from our understanding of our real relationship to God. It is not just that we respect God. It is that we see ourselves as His children, and we respect ourselves as such. All right. This leads to honoring each other and our promises to God. In an age of moral crisis due to the natural pluralizing tendencies of increased education and communication, the immediate impulse, in an age of moral crisis, the immediate impulse is to retreat to firm tradition, circle the wagons, refuse to engage in the dialogue of the times, and stress traditional values. And there's plenty of good PR in certain circles for doing this. But a better response, truer to our faith and to our best selves, is to see this as an opportunity to re-explore our theological and ethical resources and discover there the principles and ennobling insights that will re-imbue our moral lives with meaning. The LDS understanding of free human agents working with God's help and succor on a path of eternal self-realization offers such principles and insights, and we should embrace it with gratitude and proclaim it with joy. Thanks. Oh yeah, come on, please. This is the author of Dennis Potter, author of the paper I referred to earlier.
I agree with your the father of the returned missionary. I sort of hold that kind of consequentialist view, and so I just wanted to defend it a little bit, or at least raise some problems that you. So your criticism is essentially is that look, on the consequentialist view, morality just reduces to prudence. And there's a sense in which, I mean, I could actually take a page out of your playbook in responding here, and I could just say, oh, well, so what? Morality is just prudence. That's all it is. So that's one way of responding, although that bothers me a little bit responding that way. I'd rather be able to say that there is...
My first paper actually says that. In fact, that may be all there is to it. And it's not a completely impoverished view of morality. It just doesn't account for a lot of our moral sentiments.
Okay. I think that someone like Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill is just going to say that. Oh, yeah, that's all. That's all morality is just prudence for a lot of people, and not just egoistic prudence, but prudence. But I think that even the utilitarian could have a distinction between morality and prudence in the distinction between worrying about your own happiness and worrying about the happiness of others. The utilitarian wants the happiness of others as well as his own happiness. And so you might be able to construct in other words, you could explain why when someone does damage to themselves, we say, oh, well, they're not doing anything wrong, but what they're doing is really stupid. We could explain that because it's maybe they're not doing any damage to anyone else, and this is why we don't consider that fundamentally wrong. Of course, according to the utilitarian, that is somewhat wrong. Yeah, it is somewhat wrong to do damage to yourself. But it's not as wrong as doing a lot of damage to a lot of other people. So you might be able to construct some sort of distinction, or at least make sense out of the kinds of claims that we make. Oh, well, what he's doing is really stupid or imprudent, but it's not really horrendous or really morally wrong. I'll leave it at that. I had another question, but we don't have very much time. There's other people.
Thanks, Dennis. It's a big argument between consequentialism and whether it can in fact defend rights. And there's I mean that's a 10-hour discussion. But it's thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, Mark.
I wanted to make sure.
You want to come up here?
In one of your statements about somebody's response to some of these attitudes, it talked about worship of God, and I would seriously question whether God wants us to worship Him. I think what comes to mind for me is the movie Monty Python's In Search of the Holy Grail, every time God appears, everybody starts groveling, and God chastises them for groveling all the time in front of him. I think that's a good summation of probably how God feels about it. But you also talked about, you said you hadn't mentioned grace. You've been talking about the Golden Rule, and then you talked about the law upon which all of these, the law and prophets, hang, which is, as God commanded, you love one another and you love God, which is different from the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule doesn't address motivation, which may be purely selfish, whereas God's commandment to love one another, which I believe is an eternal, you know, unchangeable law, if we're talking about that, does address the issue of what is your real motivation. You can't love someone without a pure motivation. And in order to do that, you must have grace. It's full of grace. You can't love somebody unconditionally without, you know, putting forth an awful lot of grace. So it seems like that, to me, it enters into that.
Thanks very much. I agree that with the Monty Python criticism of groveling humans. And as far as I struggle with a way to my version of the Golden Rule, which is this highly philosophical version, does address motivation, okay? But I struggle with a way to put this version of the Golden Rule together with the second great commandment, which is, I think, also the mother of all. You know, it's the one that Jesus said is the, you know, that one and the first one are the whatever it was, the on this hang all the law and the prophets. And I do feel like I need to inject love and grace and some of those things that get us there into this paper. I have, you know, the idea that God's helping us somehow through this process comes out at the end, but I actually believe that. And that when I talk about the help and succor of God, that's where I find the grace in the process of not just, you know, self-improvement like, 90s self-improvement or whatever it is. Okay. Yes, please.
I'm RLDS and utilitarian more, but that's just my perspective. What I was wondering is, why do you need the foundationalist, stuff, the ultimate law, when, like, to me it's so much more persuasive for morality, just for the experience of love and watching someone else suffer, and to be persuaded by, to be a moral person by seeing the similarities in suffering in someone else and not wanting that to happen and being there for that person in love. And I'm thinking of Richard Rorty, who writes a little bit about all these rules aren't very persuasive in actually changing people's behavior. And there's also another woman ethicist I'm not thinking of, but I guess that means a lot more to me. I don't understand why you still need some foundationalist rule to have morality.
That's great. And I actually, over the 20 years since I wrote this thing, have become less satisfied with a formal approach to morality, or at least what I want to call monistic approach to morality, that all it is this one principle. Okay, when I think that it's wrong to pollute the planet, okay, which it is, and you can clearly get that from this principle, I don't believe that's the reason that it's wrong, that it conforms with this principle. I believe there's something about beauty and dignity and worth that is being violated, and the same thing is true with suffering, that there's something about human worth or dignity or something. The point of... But the problem is that the purpose of moral theory at this level that I'm trying to do it in philosophy is not actually to motivate people, okay? It's to establish an understanding of what makes something right or wrong. Now, to get people to be right or wrong, to do what's right, you know, we preach and we show them movies of car crashes and we do all kinds of things on that scale. And we give them commandments and we get them to live a certain way where they develop their moral sensitivities. And, you know, if they take enough drugs and if they screw enough people, they're going to lose their moral sensitivity. Okay? And so they really are, because you can't live that out of harmony with what's right and still feel what's right. Excuse my jargon. But that was the idea of the morality that person's in. And that, so we, to get moral behavior is, you know, I'm not sure that philosophy really gets you there, except that that I actually believe that this idea that I am creating morality, that I am deciding ultimately what I'm going to do in accordance with some really basic principles and some really mission that I have in life, is a really ennobling thing, and it is a motivating thing. And I think that in fact, a lot of the goodness that we see around us comes out of that positive view of who we are and what we're doing when we're making decisions. But I also agree that sympathy and all that sort of stuff, you know, that rules are not as good at motivating as love and as grace and all that thing. But thanks very much for your comments. We're out of time. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much, Kim. I want to remind paper that is able to be purchased, and you can also purchase the tape of the session, and have a pleasant day here. Take a deep breath.